Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 12th of January. This is a listener request, and we're so happy to present this program to you. Many of you have seen the documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car? Was it a lack of consumer confidence or a conspiracy? In 1996, you could have leased an electric car. It was called the EV1. It was made by General Motors. And the people in California who drove them loved the car, became very attached to the car, and protested when their cars were taken from them. 8 years later, GM did take the cars back, and they had them crushed and shredded and taken away from this planet. We're going to be looking at the car that was put down and why it was with the filmmaker Chris Payne. And the answer to what happened is, well, we'll find out what the answer is during the course of this hour. Interestingly enough, General Motors has introduced, some of you may be aware, another new concept car called the Volt, which is designed to use little or no gasoline. They introduced this at the car show. So what's up with GM? What's up with what happened to the electric car? It's a fascinating story. We will have several guests with us during the course of this hour. We're still trying to find Chris Payne. Rhonda was in touch with him, but he's not answering his phone right now. Before becoming a full-time filmmaker, he was an internet business pioneer, and he has produced a number of short subjects. Who Killed the Electric Car? Payne's first feature documentary as a director, and he should be joining us shortly. Until then, Rhonda has been able to find for us a couple people who owned the EV. Ones, and we'll be talking with them right now and a little bit later with Chris. Paul and Doug are joining us, and we'll hear about their experience and welcome phone calls from you, because I'm sure Paul and Doug know a lot about the EV1 as well. Paul and Doug, hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks, both. Both of you own the EV1, Paul?
Well, nobody owned the EV1.
I'm sorry. Leased it, yeah.
This is very a point of contention. I actually do own a Toyota RAV4 EV, as does Doug, and I believe Doug did lease an EV1.
We had actually two EV1s. We had the 1997 lead acid and the 1999 nickel metal hydride.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them were taken away and crushed against our wishes.
You could never own these cars, right? You could only lease them?
We sent checks in, we sent requests, we picketed, we begged General Motors to sell them, and finally General Motors, instead of selling them, arrested two would-be buyers and jailed them.
Yeah.
For blocking the sidewalk.
Tell me about the car. I would imagine you were a big fan of the car. Why did you like it? Why did you buy it?
It basically, my wife loved the 1997. It plugged in anywhere. It could plug into any 110 outlet at anybody's house.
Oh.
And it went 110 miles on a charge, up to 110 miles. She drove it to work every day, never failed her. It was quiet, it was fast, and it was a fun car to drive. It was a great way to commute to work. Before that, we had been spending about $5 a day driving a Ford F-150 pickup truck to work. And after that, you know, we didn't spend anything, because eventually we got a solar electric rooftop system and we paid for all of our driving with our solar electric production.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul, in fact, also, he has a solar electric system which he uses to produce energy in the daytime, and he charges his RAV4 EV at night. Why can't we have our EV1? You know, why can't we have a Volt?
Right. Now, part of the reason that California people got the EV1 is because you were under a mandate, or at least the automakers were, to have cars that had no emissions by a certain date. Is that right, Paul?
Yes. It's called the Zero Emission Vehicle, or ZEV, mandate, and it was passed by the Air Resources Board in 1990, and it required that by 1998, 2% of the cars sold in California had to be zero emission, and that number was to have gone up to 10% by 2003.
Mm-hmm.
So had it stayed in effect, we would have literally tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of EVs on the road today.
Mm-hmm. And GM was saying, at least the people in the film from GM were saying, well, this just wasn't a very popular car. There just wasn't the demand for this car.
Yeah, that was a flat-out lie, and General Motors should be ashamed for saying that. And they continue to say today that there was no demand for the car, but that is a flat-out lie. They leased every single car that they made available with virtually no advertising, so you had to seek it out.
Hmm.
And then there was a list of some 5,000 people who had also inquired and wanted to lease the car as well, and they were denied the chance to do so.
How was it discovered? The dramatic part of the film, well, it's all pretty dramatic, but when the last car was taken away, because you had to turn your cars in after so many years, they wouldn't let you buy the cars. Who discovered that these cars were being taken to Arizona and literally crushed? Why would you crush all these cars?
Well, that's a good question. General Motors could have sold these for $25,000 each, and yet they actually paid money between $600 and $800 each to take the batteries out, to take the tires off, to crush them, and then to haul them back to California to put into the shredder. So they actually paid money to destroy them instead of selling them for cash money. Paul presented them with a check for $2.5 million, which they refused.
Yeah, so these cars, you know, the reason they wanted to do this is they wanted to get rid of any evidence that the cars existed. And they tried desperately, all the car companies. It wasn't just GM. Toyota is just as guilty. They destroyed over 500 of their Toyota RAV4 EVs prior to our protests, which finally shamed them into stopping. Toyota at least had the decency to stop crushing, and we saved about 800 of those cars.
Uh-huh. And they have, I'm interested in your response to this car and whether or not it's different here. Here we are a couple of years later, and at the auto show this week, we got General Motors unveiling, and here's the way the Reuters news report goes. Its once failed idea of a mass market electric car unveiling a new concept car called the Volt, designed to use little or no gasoline, introduced at the North American Auto Show this week.
That's the so-called serial plug-in hybrid. And it allows you to drive 40, 50, 100 miles as big a battery as you want to buy in all-electric mode at up to 80 miles an hour, maybe faster. And then, on the occasional long trip, a gas engine, you only need a 1,000cc gas engine generator, generates enough energy to drive your car at up to 80 miles an hour as far as you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a car that we laud General Motors for bringing it out. But the problem is they're stonewalling. They already have the battery. The batteries already exist. As in Paul's RAV4 EV has been running faultlessly for 5 years on these nickel metal hydride batteries, which do everything the Volt needs. And the 1999 General Motors car used those batteries. So why aren't they just releasing it? Why do more research?
They're saying that the batteries just aren't up to speed yet. You're saying they already exist.
Yeah,
two RAV4 EVs that say they do work.
we've got several hundred of these RAVs running around, some of them with in excess of 100,000 miles.
Wow.
No battery.
Wow, you're kidding me.
No, this is absolutely true. And so for General Motors to say that the batteries are not ready is, you know, again, you know, they're they tend not to tell the truth. But the lithium-ion batteries, which they're trying to make work now, their own chief engineer at MIT stated that the batteries were already good enough, that all they had to do was put them into bundles big enough to drive the car. And so for them to say that it's going to be 2010 or 2012 before the cars are ready just doesn't strike us as factual. You know, it doesn't take 3 to 5 years to bundle these batteries up. Maybe
what they're trying to do is to get people to think that General Motors is answering the film that Chris, thank goodness, did, which documented the horror that happened. So they're figuring in 3 or 4 years everybody will forget about it and it'll be a dead issue.
Right.
Well, it won't be a dead issue because we're not going to let it die, but here's what we're telling people to do is to call GM and Toyota and tell them we're not going to buy a new car from anybody until it's got a plug on it. And then don't. Keep whatever you've got now. Keep driving it. And just tell the car manufacturers that you want a car that runs on domestic, cleaner, cheaper electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to sign up for that campaign, let me plug Paul's company, Paul's organization, PluginAmerica.com. It's a nonprofit. You can go to it. You can sign up. You can join up. Join the campaign to free America from oil dependence anemia.
Mm-hmm. And tell us this story. It's such a poignant story of the gentleman whose name escapes me at the moment who developed this top-notch battery in the film. And then that was gotten rid of as well.
Well, Stan Ovshinsky and his wife, the late Iris Ovshinsky, they were the geniuses that invented not only these batteries, but also a new kind of solar panel. And their invention was purchased, control of the worldwide patent rights was purchased by General Motors under the guise that they were going to produce this car, the EV1. Then they were just stonewalled it and wouldn't produce it. They produced it in 1998, the nickel metal version, and then they stonewalled until almost 2000 before, you know, being forced to release them. And then General Motors, instead of using these batteries, actually sold them to Texaco, which 2 weeks later announced it was merging with Chevron. So now Chevron owns these batteries. But the irony is General Motors once owned control of the batteries needed for the Toyota Prius and all other production electric cars. Lithium is a good potential battery, but the only battery that's proven to last longer than the life of the car is nickel metal hydride.
Mm-hmm.
And General Motors owned those and sold them.
Let's welcome phone calls for our guests. We're talking, and more power to Rhonda for finding these gentlemen who own EVs. One is with Plug-in America. We hope to talk to the director of Who Killed the Electric Car, and he's just not answering his phone right now, so I don't know what he's doing, taking a spin in another electric car or whatever. But at any rate, these two guys are great. They were very happy electric car owners, and they are still operating alternative to gasoline vehicles. We're looking at the story that was found in the film and welcoming your calls at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Who Killed the Electric Car is our topic of conversation this hour. And we are speaking with Doug Kortoff, who is an EV1 owner. And Paul Scott is also with us with PluginAmerica.com. And they're very, very high on this electric car. They thought they were terrific. And we're hearing the story of why it is that they were not allowed to buy them, even though Paul offered $2.5 million for one of the cars, and why these cars were all crushed. So, if you've seen the film, there are a lot of aspects to this, and we're talking about the mandate that cars had to have a certain percentage of cars emission-free. We're looking at people who made batteries. We're looking at fuel cell, which we have yet to talk about, technology, et cetera. And so that's what's happening this hour. And we go to Paul from Washington County for our first call. Gentlemen, hi, Paul.
Good morning. Has any studies been made as the Japanese producers of these vehicles come online as to how that will affect the power generation capacity of the U.S., you know, both coal and nuclear and hydro, et cetera? I mean, I have to agree with this approach. Clearly, a high-efficiency battery you would avoid a lot of pollution in your metropolitan areas. Let's say that's my question. You know, if you bring a million of these online a year and they're plugged into your receptacle at home, that's obviously going to tax our generation system, which is probably marginal as it is.
Yeah, the answer to that is a recent study was conducted by the Department of Energy that concluded that 80% of the nation's fleet of cars, that's some 180 million vehicles, could be charged on the excess capacity of the nighttime grid.
Hmm.
Since most electric vehicles are charged at night because they do take several hours to charge if, you know, you're using household current. So people drive them during the day, and then they come home and they park them and they charge them overnight. So the nighttime grid has, you know, a tremendous amount of excess capacity. And this is what the grid is today. You know, obviously what we advocate at Plug-in America is that we add renewable energy to the grid every time you bring one of these cars on. A 2-kilowatt solar system will generate enough electricity for the entire year for the average American driver. And that doesn't cost more than, you know, $15,000 or $16,000. And it'll last 40 or 50 years. So if you run the numbers on that, how much gas will you be buying over the next 30 to 50 years?
Mm-hmm.
It'll easily pencil out.
Can I add to that from personal experience, we have a modest solar electric system on our roof, which provides all of our domestic electric, and it provides enough electric for 2 electric cars running 20,000 miles a year each.
Wow.
Plus, we donated $99 in electric to the grid last year and $89 the year before that, and right now we're $200 ahead. The nighttime charging of electric cars actually helps the grid amortize expensive generating equipment and avoid the nighttime low when they have to ramp down generators, while the solar energy on your roof actually provides a clean extra solar plant. You know, the combination of all the solar rooftops in California and Texas and all the other places where there's sun, and even in Wisconsin, because in Wisconsin you can use Stan Ovshinsky solar panels to make enough electric to make it worthwhile. All that new solar capacity would not only provide a new solar plant, a new power plant in aggregate, but would provide enough power to charge all the cars for all the people that drove using those household electricity.
Mm. What's the push for, and is it still as strong a push for fuel cell?
Fuel cells depend on hydrogen, but hydrogen has to be generated, and hydrogen is four times the energy to generate it as electricity. Now, if you look at my electric car, the EV1 went up to 6 miles on each kilowatt hour of electricity. It only held 18 kilowatt hours. That's the energy equivalent of a half a gallon of gas, on which it went up to 110 miles. So it uses basically the most efficient car in the world. It uses basically no energy, very little energy.
Yeah, and also with the fuel cells, you're going to have to establish a fueling infrastructure for the hydrogen, and so you'll be buying it from the oil companies, and this infrastructure is going to cost upwards of $500 billion to implement, and whereas the electric grid is already everywhere, so you wouldn't have to do anything but essentially buy an extension cord.
So you're saying then because the oil companies are involved in this, that's why there's such a push for research in this area, even though
it'll be... Absolutely, yes. And also, President Bush also wants to build 500 nuclear plants in order to generate the electricity to make the hydrogen.
And another thing is, you know, they're pushing for hydrogen, but as Toyota points out, that won't be before 2025 at the earliest. So, basically what they're saying is, you know, let us continue to rip off the people with gasoline and continue to burn all this gasoline, which contributes to global warming, and do all these oil wars for another generation. But we don't have to. There is an alternative right now. The Chevrolet Volt, if it were issued right now, could free up 80% of our gasoline usage, because we don't do that many long-distance trips. And on the trips that you do take, the Volt is not limited. It can go 100 miles in electric mode or 40 miles in electric mode, and then it can go as far as you want on those times and occasions when you take a long trip.
Mm-hmm.
We need that car now, not in 2025. We don't need fuel cells in the future. We need electric cars now.
Why aren't we getting them?
Oil companies running our country. Look at this. Cheney, Rice, Bush, they're all oil people.
You agree with that, Paul?
Well, absolutely. They have been keeping a lot of the perfect technology, which is the battery electric car, could be available today. I mean, they made over 5,000 of these vehicles in the late 90s, and they could have had hundreds of thousands of them by now.
Yeah.
The difference between the fuel cell car and the battery electric is the fuel cell car is a car they say they want to build, but they can't, and the battery electric is a car that they can build but won't.
Thanks very much for the call. We are going to include Chris Payne, who's the director of the film. Rhonda's going to get him on the line, and Paul will stay with us. Doug, we thank you very much for joining us to talk about your experience. Chris will be with us momentarily, and we'll take more phone calls. 800-486-8655. John from Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, John.
Hi. I'm not sure if you guys covered it because I was off for a while I was talking with the caller. But one of the things that it can do, the electric car can do, is it can actually reduce the infrastructure cost for electricity, because all of the cars, once they drive to work and they plug back into the grid, if employers would allow them to do that for recharging, it acts as a bank where electricity can be stored. And one of the big problems we have in metropolitan areas is that during the daytime, we use a tremendous amount of electricity, and they have to build a generator that's big enough for the largest peak demand. Now, if you have all of these electric cars, when people are at work plugged into the grid, they could be intelligent electric cars that have a storage of energy in them that they charged up at night, and when the peak demand comes, they could sell electricity back to the grid. So the car could actually earn money for the actual owner and also reduce our infrastructure costs, because you don't have to build as big a generator then. You can have a much smaller, and you don't have as much more growth in coal-fired plants or whatever, because you make use of the plants that exist already, better use of the plants that exist. You don't need new plants to be able to feed the peak demand.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
This is called vehicle-to-grid, and I couldn't explain it any better than John. He did a terrific job. It's absolutely necessary that we move to these types of cars. And this is one of the great benefits of battery electric cars, is it does enable us to have this huge supply, when there are millions of these cars on the road, this huge supply of clean off-peak energy to use during peak time.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, John, very much for calling in and for your wisdom. Chris Payne is with us now. Before becoming a full-time filmmaker, he was an internet business pioneer. Who Killed the Electric Car has really gathered a lot of attention, and it was Payne's first feature documentary as a director. He will be joining us. We'll continue taking phone calls. And Paul Scott is with us, owner of an EV1 and working with PluginAmerica.com. Hi, Chris. Thanks very much for being with us. Yeah, turn on the right button here, Kathleen. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. This film has really created quite a furor, hasn't it?
Well, I guess it has, yeah. I think maybe the timing was right for this,
yes,
for this story.
Mm-hmm. And did you happen upon it, or were you one of these people who were fond of electric cars, or how did you get the story out?
Well, I saw that the electric car was coming back in the 90s, that GM was going to introduce it, so I thought I would give it a shot, and I kind of leased one on a lark to see, well, what's this going to be like for me? Is it going to possibly work? And my other car was an SUV, and, you know, I had a Ford Explorer or something, and I thought, well, this might be like a part-time car. But, boy, within a month or two, it was almost the only car I was driving. Even with a limited range, it was just filled in almost all my needs. So 5 years later, when the cars were called off the road and they said that nobody wanted them, and none of the major news programs did any stories about them.
Right.
So we decided, well, let's make a film.
Yeah. They not only didn't do any news stories, but they didn't follow this huge story of all these cars being crushed. I mean, I still can't believe they did that to all these cars. They crushed them.
I know. It's absurd. Just absurd. And, you know, they say, well, we had spare parts problems, and there was problems with, legal issues and so forth. And these arguments all have a little bit of credibility, but the bigger issue is really they didn't, and these cars should have been kept on the roads because people were very happy to drive them.
What did GM say, Paul, when you offered $2.5 million for one of these cars?
Well, it was actually $1.9 million.
I'm sorry.
Stipulated value of the 78 existing cars in their parking lot.
Uh-huh.
They said nothing. They totally ignored us. And then a few days later, hauled trucks in and loaded up the cars and then hauled them out to Arizona and crushed them. And this is a company that is in dire financial straits, refusing cash money for vehicles that they had already manufactured.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Chris, next caller from La Crosse. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for your movie, Chris.
Sure.
I find it scary thought that Americans, investors could be ignored. And so what better day than Halloween for me to see the showing of it in Fairfield, Iowa? But I think that there's a lot of good news, and particularly some good news here in Wisconsin. Earlier guests were talking about lithium-ion batteries.
Mm-hmm.
And Johnson Controls in Milwaukee is one of the companies in the country who are looking at providing lithium-ion solutions for the automotive industry.
Hmm.
Also, there's neighborhood electric vehicles that are available, and there's a manufacturer right here in Wisconsin in Reedsburg. It's called Columbia Parcar.
Columbia what?
Columbia Parcar.
Parcar.
You can visit them at parcar.com.
Okay.
And it's not plural. It's just parcar.com.
Uh-huh.
There is also neighborhood electric vehicle and fuel cell clinics available every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock in La Crosse at the Honda dealership.
Mm-hmm.
And they're currently giving out a free DVD of an inconvenient truth for people to attend.
Oh, my.
But we should really be giving away who killed the electric car. So my question to Chris is, where can I purchase the DVDs in bulk?
Well, Paul, you might be able to answer that as well as I could. You know, it's Sony owns the film, and they control wholesaling of the film and things like that. I know with Inconvenient Truth, Participant Films was involved, and that was a lot of money that was being donated for them to get that film out at a very low rate to people.
Mm-hmm.
Our film is slightly different. You know, it was Sony ended up controlling the rights to it, and so we have to sort of go through Sony to
sure.
get copies.
But we do sell the film on our website, pluginamerica.com, and mm-hmm. we do offer a bulk rate.
Wonderful.
Great. Okay, there's your answer, right, Chris?
Yes, thank
yeah,
you
and
so much.
It's great to hear, you know, we've been talking to a lot of people, and Paul can tell you as well as I can that there's groups all over the country that are sort of raising awareness, and the more consumers really get on the horn and say, hey, I want this, I like this technology, I'd check it out, I would take the risk, it gives car companies more and more reason to take those risks too.
Mm-hmm.
I've been driving a neighborhood electric vehicle now for a little over 3 weeks, and I didn't think that I could live my life with it, but it turns out that I have not had to use my conventional vehicle for 3 weeks now. So it's really a unique experience driving on electricity only, and it's really wonderful. I get lots of thumbs up and waves here in La Crosse, so we look forward to helping move forward your concept of only buying a car with a plug on it. I used to drive a hybrid, and my license plate was no plug, and I was getting grief occasionally for doing that. Now I need to get a license plate, yes, plug.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Well, this is exactly such an interesting point because even Ford, when they came out with their Escape, their web blog magazine they had was called Unplugged. And those of us in the plug-in world said, well, when was the Escape ever something you could plug in? And there's sort of this unusual subconscious anti-marketing about plugs, and I hope maybe we could turn that around here.
Yeah, yeah. Chris, thanks so much for your information. We'll follow through on what you've been talking about and do a Wisconsin show on this. Ron
That'd
is nodding
great,
your head.
Kathleen.
Yeah, it'd be great. Thanks, Chris, for the call. Jim is next from Stoughton. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks so much for the show. This is something that's really got me excited recently. I had the chance to see the movie and got really fired up about it, and I've been trying to look what the best option would be for me. I have heard about the neighborhood electric vehicles, and thanks for that last caller. That's a great resource, that Park Car.
Yes.
But I was looking into Tesla. They unveiled their latest concept car, and I believe you can actually buy it, but it's really pricey. It's like $100,000 for this car, but it's really nice, really sporty. And I was just wondering, are there any other options? I know I've looked at possibly converting my own car to an electric car, and that's a possibility, but I haven't found anybody close to home that does that. But are there any other cars on the market, you know, aside from the real high-end ones? I know the Volt was something new, but like you said, that's not out yet, correct?
That's right, yeah. Well, you know, Tesla has another less expensive car that's on the horizon called the White Star. And
okay.
That's going to be, you know, half the price or less of their current car. So it's kind of exciting to see a new player in the car industry trying to move into, a low mass market vehicle in the short term. Paul, can you think of any other cars you can buy right now?
None that you can buy right now, other than there are several NEV companies like Miles Automotive and Zen Cars out of Canada. Those you can buy today. The highway capable cars are on the horizon. Miles has one that's going to have a 200-mile range and an 80-mile-an-hour top speed that will sell for under $30,000, but it won't be available until the end of 2008. So we're still a year to 2 years away from seeing more of these highway-capable cars, but they are coming. And so
Great.
What we advocate is that you just keep whatever you have now or buy a used car, but don't buy anything new until it's got a plug on it.
That's a great idea, yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. You know, what's really frustrating about this is that, you know, we wait till the end of 2008 or whatever, and here you guys had them in California, and everybody loved them, and then they were crushed.
They threw them in the garbage. And
yeah.
All of these cars had $13,000 of state and federal tax money in it. Your money, our money, and they instead of selling them to willing customers, they took them away forcefully and literally crushed and threw them in the garbage.
Yeah. What about the repairs? I've also, and this is the subject of the film as well, that it just doesn't cost very much to maintain these cars, and that was upsetting to people who maintain cars.
Well, this is a jobs issue for people who are in the business of repairing cars. But what I would advocate is that anybody who is thinking about entering into that business, you know, maybe think about getting into another line of work, because as the electric cars come online, you know, the existing internal combustion engine cars will still need to be maintained and repaired, but the electric cars will need very little of that. So it will be a job displacement issue down the road, but again, you know, you just don't enter into that work, and the existing 200 plus million cars that are on the road today will still be need to be maintained by whoever is in that business of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I would offer sort of a slightly different perspective on that. I mean, the argument's made that electric cars, because they don't have transmissions per se, and there's no tune-ups and far fewer parts, it's a much simpler motor, i.e. there is no engine, to maintain. So that costs the consumer a lot less money. On the other hand, replacing or, you know, replacing large parts of the American fleet will create many jobs in terms of those kinds of conversions and those kinds of manufacturing. So I think electric cars probably won't, you know, decrease the amount of jobs out there. If anything, it would probably increase it, especially if, as a nation, we get behind building, rebuilding our electric infrastructure and building renewables on our grid.
Let's go to Anton from Madison. Hi, Anton.
Hey, guys. Excellent conversation this morning, right up my alley. I work for a data center company in Madison managing the power distribution, and one of my keen interests in the last 7 years of my career has been on electrical, it basically is electrical engineering and how to get things denser and denser and denser. And one of the things that dawns on me is that doing some rough calcs back of the napkin, to equate to the performance that folks enjoy today in their, maybe not enjoy, but using their gasoline vehicles, we would need 70 or 100 kilowatts worth of stored power, considering the range and the kind of horsepower that even a moderate V6 can produce. And I guess what I'm thinking about is if cars, like you're saying, are going to be increasingly highway capable in the electrical sphere, what are we going to do for people who need now to draw 80, 70 amps all night long to get that 60, 70 kilowatts worth of power in those batteries in neighborhoods where we know the transformers probably aren't over 115 kilowatts or 200 kilowatts worth of conversion abilities? I guess I see the benefit here, but I see that there's going to be a lot of work to do, especially in rural areas in Wisconsin, where power distribution simply probably couldn't handle every consumer using their full drop ability to their home.
Well, this is an excellent point, and it underscores the need for a national program to really rebuild our electric infrastructure. Our whole electric system was built in the 30s, and a lot of it, as we all learned during the Enron fiasco in California anyway, and certainly with some of the blackouts, is the system is not optimized and really needs some capital. However, the good news is the utilities have looked at these electric car issues, and the number that was given to me by the folks at Southern California Edison last time we saw them was that 200 million cars could be charged at night every night. Maybe you already covered this earlier when it wasn't on the show. But that's a tremendous amount of charging that can happen with existing infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Just it depends on the area, as your caller is pointing out.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing to keep in mind is that electric cars are extremely efficient. So comparing them with gas cars and the equivalent energy needs doesn't really work. You can drive an electric car. My Toyota will go about 3 or 4 miles on 1 kilowatt hour of power, and the Tesla can probably go about 6 miles on 1 kilowatt hour of power. So if you look at your electric bill and see how many kilowatt hours you use in your house, most people, as a matter of fact, I'm in the solar energy business, so I see people's electric bills all the time. And I can drive my car on enough energy that, you know, most people just waste in their homes. So with a little conservation in your house, you can transfer the wasted energy that you're currently using non-productively to drive your car, which would offset all of your gas usage. So, mm-hmm. you know, literally, the United States, with a little bit of conservation and efficiency, could replace virtually all of the gasoline use with electricity that's currently being, you know, essentially wasted.
Well, and what do you guys see for the horizon of storage technology? Are we going to see things that are 70, 80 kilowatts worth of storage in a battery in reasonable weight, or is this going to be a couple years out, or is this a year?
Well, I don't think that we're even going to need that. You know, my car uses about 27 kilowatt hours, and I can go 120 miles. But if you needed to go 300 miles, you know, your best bet is to use a plug-in hybrid. You know, mm-hmm. most people don't drive very far. You know, maybe 40 miles a day is the average, or less than that. So if you had a car with 150-mile range, you know, which is very easy, you could do that with 30 kilowatt hours. That's not a lot of power at all. And if you needed like 40 miles a day, you know, divide that by, you know, 3 or 4, and that's how many kilowatt hours you need. It's just not that much power.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess if these cars can touch the lives of the majority of us who just do daily commuting but don't have the need for a 400-mile-per-tank range car, then this will offset exactly what you're talking about in terms of the total consumption of gas by the majority of the users. Mm-hmm. So it should be a good thing. Thank you guys for your information.
Thanks, Anton. Thanks for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Who killed the electric car? That's the focus of our conversation this hour. We're talking with the director of the film. Chris Payne is with us, and we're also speaking with Paul Scott. Paul is with Plug-in America and was the owner of the EV1 featured in the film, and is the owner of an electric car now as well. And, well, here's our number, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now. Joe from Richland Center, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having this program. I'm enjoying it.
Good.
My question kind of is related to the last callers, and that is that I wonder about vehicles with more power. I farm, and right now I drive a diesel truck, and I need, you know, my mom has a Prius, and it's an awesome car, but I need more carrying capacity and power than any of these electric cars provide. I mean, I guess I wanted to ask what your thoughts are for the future of trucks, because, you know, for example, I spend quite a bit of fuel when I drive an hour to go pick something up. Hauling back, I need the power, but on the way there, I'm driving, you know, this huge thing. I've looked into biodiesel and stuff, but I just wondered specifically what you see as maybe mm-hmm. the future for trucks.
All right, Joe.
That's a great question. Well, of course, if you talk to the OEMs out there, they'll say that the only market that exists right now for electric drives are in big trucks. I shouldn't say big trucks, but in industrial applications, you know, warehouse units that are everywhere. It's the Army has an electric tank. I mean, there's some huge industrial applications for electric motors in mining and all kinds of applications. The question is can we port this technology to what's used, you know, current trucking industry and all the rest of it? And I think the short-term answer is certainly hybrid technologies. You know, the GM built a bunch of hybrid buses that they've been rolling out slowly to various cities. And, of course, hybrids automatically have the advantage, as you just pointed out, like when you have a lighter load or you're driving back, you don't need quite as much power. And when you step on those brakes, you're regenerating your power back into your battery supplies. So there's a lot of, like, interim technology that could really be applied, and we hope that with greater consumer awareness, as your caller is pointing out, that this is going to slowly push the manufacturers into doing this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, I want to add that the electric motors are extremely powerful. As a matter of fact, freight trains that haul thousands of tons of materials, those are electric vehicles. They're essentially serial hybrids, much like the Chevy Volt that was introduced last week. They have a giant electric motor that drives the wheels and a diesel engine that does nothing but generate electricity. The diesel does not turn the wheels. So those are essentially plug-in hybrids.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Jennifer next from Washington Island. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I have a question for any of the gentlemen who thinks they might be able to answer this. Regarding the cars that were pulled off the market and then destroyed in California, what kind of pressure was GM put under to get rid of these cars and, you know, stymie the development of the technology? Who put pressure on them? Was any of that pressure illegal? Was the oil industry involved? And if any of it was illegal, what is being done to hold the oil industry or the folks put pressure on? What's being done to hold them accountable for that?
Chris?
Well, the Who Killed the Electric Car movie tries to trace this story as well as it can in a 90-minute format. And, you know, the oil companies do not sit on the board of the car companies, and the car companies don't sit on the boards of the oil companies. So, I mean, in general. And certainly there wasn't evidence of that happening. However, in California, it worked naturally that industry cooperates when they see issues that are, you know, potentially threatening. And in this case, electric cars were threatening because car companies didn't think they could make any money on them, and they didn't want to be told what to do. And oil industry was very interested in making sure they didn't lose their monopoly on transportation fuel. So they had the thing that I fault the oil companies most for is creating all these shell organizations that they financed through PR organizations with names like Consumers Against Utility Company Abuse and
right.
California's
yeah.
and all this kind of nonsense, and then advertising in national magazines that electric cars weren't ready and that you really didn't want them and that they might be unsafe and look out for battery acid. Well, this kind of tampering with the free market, I think, is really counterproductive. And so that's one reason we set out to make the film, to really show what happens in a supposed free market when big industry feels threatened. It can be not very free.
Mm-hmm. We haven't a chance to hear your reaction, Chris, to GM releasing the Volt over the weekend. What do you think of that car? And why did they release it?
Well, I think it's terrific. I went to Detroit to look at the car, and you know, we told GM that we're not interested in, you know, banging them over the head like Michael Moore for all eternity until they're bankrupt. If they're going to make good decisions, we're going to support them. And I think this is an excellent decision. It's obviously 10 years later they should be making it, but but here they are. And, you know, this car will go 40 miles on all electric, and then it will give you a 600-mile range thanks to its, you know, reserve fuel tanks that kick in. This is a good move. And obviously, the proof's in the pudding. For them to roll out a prototype is one thing. For them to have something that we can drive and put in our driveways is a
right.
different. And I hope that consumer pressure and consumer interest in this car will really continue to encourage GM, and not just GM, but all the car makers to add plugs to their cars.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what the film really points to quite definitely, and we're hearing from the audience too, is there definitely is consumer interest in this. There's no doubt about that, right?
That's right. That's right.
And that was one of the most frustrating things about this whole thing is that the auto companies all claimed in unison that there was no public demand for electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let's go to Sharon next from Green Bay. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I'm in the market for a car right now, and I've been looking at American. I'd like to get an SUV as well as I looked at Toyota. However, the American Ford and Chevy dealerships had said, be careful about the hybrid, because if you get in an accident, EMS workers don't want to touch you in the car. And I'd like to know if that's true.
Who said that?
Because of the battery.
Patently absurd. The oil industry was literally shipping people to these meetings in California in the 90s to testify about their concern about getting shocked by electric cars, you know, and playing on people's fears of these things. And Toyota system, I mean, yes, they have had a couple of incidents, but nothing compared to, you know, how people get damaged by gasoline burns from, you know, in accidents and so forth. It's always shocking to me. Don't you think, Paul, when you hear car dealers
really?
Trying to scare people away from hybrids, it's just absurd.
Yeah, this is all part of their campaign to try to kill the technology, and they're pretty effective at it because they, you know, people are easily scared by, you know, somebody telling them you could get shocked or something. But when you consider that all these other cars are running around with volatile gases that explode on impact, then, you know, you got to wonder which is the most dangerous vehicle.
And to be fair, I mean, there are obviously when you have an electric system on a car, you need to have safety protections. But these cars do have them, and the whole systems are very safe, and certainly comparable with any gasoline car.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Sharon, for calling. Tom from La Crosse, hi.
Hi. People have been talking about how expensive this is all going to be, especially politicians, transmission lines, so forth and so on. I would like to point out that we just need the political will. This war has cost us $500 billion, which I believe is what would cost, as one of your guests said, would cost to put hydrogen infrastructure in the whole country. You know, global warming is too expensive to do anything about. I would like for people to just realize that we could do it. That's all I would like to have your guests comment.
All right. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Chris?
Yeah, we could do it. the glass is half full. I mean, I think, you know, I like to think sometimes that if you really do the math on things, things can be pretty depressing. But the only way out of these messes is for us to really try to be proactive and think optimistically and make better decisions.
Mm-hmm. Another issue on the money side of things is, you know, we spent in 2005 $320 billion for foreign oil. And in 2006, it's likely to be about $400 billion.
Wow.
That money left our country and went to other countries. Many of those countries, like Saudi Arabia and Iraq, you know, don't really like us. So that money should be staying here in our country, building schools and hospitals and putting up solar and windmills instead of going to enrich Saudi princes so they can buy another Rolls.
Right. Bob from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good morning. Quick question. I was always surprised when the hybrids first came out. When you think about hybrid technology, you see an electric motor with a gasoline engine, which is a brilliant concept, really. And it occurs to me that because of the extreme torquiness of electric motors, I mean, electric motors are almost 100% torque. And so it seems to me that for both that reason and for the reason of relative gain, it would have made a lot more sense to put that stuff into, like, large semi-trucks first. Because a semi-truck, if it saves, I mean, right now you're going from, let's say, a Honda Civic, which gets 30 miles a gallon anyway, to a hybrid Honda Civic, which gets, you know, 40 miles a gallon. If you go from an 18-wheeler that gets, like, 5 miles a gallon to an 18-wheeler that gets 30 or 20 or 30 miles a gallon, the percentage increase is so much greater.
Mm.
And also, you get the torque at the low end. There was a farmer that called in earlier. Well, electric motors are 100% torque transmission almost. If not for the weight of the batteries, all Formula One cars would actually be electric.
Well, there's a lot of work being done right now in the hybrid vehicles are really starting to eke into the large trucks, like garbage trucks and long-haul trucks. So I think you'll start seeing them in another year or two on the roads. And the caller is exactly right. This is a big area where a tremendous amount of fuel is being wasted. And you'll start seeing these pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Chris from Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thank you for this program. It's really great. And I just wanted to say that as far as economics and people saying stuff isn't economic, I think really economics is just the will of the people made manifest in the world. And so you just have to have the will, like the previous caller had said. But I was really calling in about there's a cult classic film. I don't remember the name of it, but it's basically Who Killed the Streetcar.
Mm.
And it implicates GM using front companies to buy these streetcar companies or alternately start busing service in order to destroy the streetcars across the nation. So they've done this before, and they're willing to do it again, I'm sure.
Yeah, Chris, why don't you talk about that? Part of that is in your film, that there were electric cars a long time ago.
Well, sure, there are electric cars. At the turn of the century, there were as many electric cars on the road as there were gas cars. If you go back to 1906, in fact, New York still has charging stations, I think, from this era.
But, yeah, I mean, this
Chris could just finish because we're almost out of time.
Oh, sure. Well, the caller's referring to the 1940s and 50s when the tire and the and the auto companies essentially conspired to pull out streetcars in countries all in cities all over the country. We have a little piece on the, on our DVD about that, and yeah, it's a big shame. But the difference now is it's our auto industry is going bankrupt. The technology's been moving to Japan, and,
right.
and they're not going to get away with this kind of stuff going forward. And if anything, they really need to get behind new technology and alternatives because this is where the money is.
Yeah. Well, look who the biggest sellers are in the United States now. It's not the American companies anymore.
And Toyota's moving into number one, they say. Yeah, but, you know, the sad thing, I was at the Detroit Auto Show, and this is GM had the most environmentally friendly prototype by a long shot there, and Toyota was rolling out full-size Tundra trucks to get 14 miles per gallon.
Oh, my gosh.
It's up to consumers to really ask for what we want.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Thanks, gentlemen, so much. What an interesting hour, and thanks for the film, too. Our family really enjoyed seeing it. Thanks.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Mm-hmm. Chris Payne, a filmmaker, his film is Who Killed the Electric Car? Paul Scott is with PluginAmerica.com. More information about the film, go to PluginAmerica.com, and you'll find more information about the film. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and finding extra guests at the very last minute. A lot of pressure on her today, and also for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Copies of this show, call the radio store, 800-747-7444. 112E is the number, and this show repeats tonight at 10 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.